You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome again to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Ansel. Tonight's show is being underwritten by IBEW Local 124 and the American Federation of Government Employees Local 1336. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 124 supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We've been wiring Kansas City since 1905, and if you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. And the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1336, represents Social Security employees across the states of Kansas and Missouri and in Omaha, Nebraska, Des Moines, Iowa, and Dallas, Texas. Unions ensure a fair and equitable work environment. We are the voice for those who have none. Strength in numbers. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, when we talk about labor organizing these days, we rarely talk about farm workers who have been left in the dust in wages, working conditions, and rights. Tonight on the show, we're going to talk to Farm Worker Justice and Missouri Legal Aid about conditions and remedies. Then, in the second half of the show, Erica Smiley, Executive Director of National Jobs with Justice, has a new book. It's called The Future We Need. She'll be here to talk about what bargaining and organizing could look like for organized labor in coming years and how unions could change. In the news, the UAW had a hell of a rally yesterday in Kansas City, Kansas. And did the Writers Guild strike win protection against AI? We'll find out. Our feature is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg, and we're going to be talking about Trump. Now for the news. And now for the news from our side, September 28th, 2023. Spirits were high and voices were loud at Wednesday's rally at United Auto Workers Local 31 in Kansas City, Kansas. The General Motors Fairfax plant has been shut down since last Wednesday because of parts shortages from the Wentzville, Missouri plant, which is on strike. Hundreds of workers and supporters rallied at least 3 hours as dozens of speakers expressed solidarity, including Kansas Governor Laura Kelly, who asked all the public officials present to come forward and introduce themselves. By our count, there were at least 24, including mayors from Kansas City, Kansas and Kansas City, Missouri, the KCK district attorney, and many Democrat state representatives and senators from Wyandotte, Leavenworth, and Johnson counties, including even one from Wichita and a city council person, Robert Sauls, a member of Firefighters Local 42 from Independence, Missouri. When they introduced themselves, many of the officials declared their union pedigrees. KCMO Mayor Quentin Lucas gave a fiery speech. Here's a bit of it.
When my mom was a secretary who was struggling, and y'all, I ain't gonna go deep in it, but we was living in a raggedy one-bedroom apartment, me and my two sisters. right? We had insects everywhere. We were living in something that was tough. But you all were standing for us. Because when you get better wages, when you get benefits you deserve, when you can take care of your families, it's amazing how that works out for literally every other worker in America. Thank you for that. So by being here right now, and I hope everybody here knows it, and I know y'all do, this isn't just about United Auto Workers. This isn't just about General Motors or Ford. This is about fundamentally standing up for working people. And that is what you're doing right now. And so the reason we stand here on this hot day is because we are going to stand for every worker, not just in Kansas City, not just in the Midwest, but in all of America to get what they are owed. And what you are owed is justice. What you are owed is fair pay. What you are owed are benefits. What you are owed is health care. And what you are owed is just a little bit of what the CEO gets. Yeah. If they can make $10, $15, $20 million, can't they just pay you $10 an hour more? Yeah. If they can make all this money and make sure that they can go anywhere, don't you deserve enough sick days to make sure you can take care of your children?
Yeah. Yeah. Then reports that the big three automakers are losing in the court of public opinion about the UAW strike and negotiations. Business intelligence firm Caliber conducted a survey which found that Ford, Stellantis, and General Motors have seen significant decrease in several reputational metrics since September 15th when the strike began. Increasing numbers of people say that they are less likely to consider the carmakers' products, recommend them to others, or work for them. Besides that, Caliber found that 80% of responders were aware of the strike. Another poll by IPOIS found 58% Americans say that they support striking auto workers, 72% of Democrats, and 63% of independents share that this sentiment, along with 48% of Republicans.
The same poll by Ipsos found that 60% of Americans support the Writers Guild of America strike, which ended at midnight Wednesday morning with a deal between the union and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers that will still have to be ratified by the membership in a vote that's going to take place between October 2nd and 9th. The 11,550 members of the Writers Guild returned to work yesterday. The three-year agreement includes important increases in residuals and streaming services and modest wage increases between 5% and 3.5% each year. As for the big issue of artificial intelligence, there will be a bar on the use of AI for writing or rewriting literary material and forbids studios from enforcing writers to use it. However, writers are allowed to choose the use of AI to aid their writing upon receiving consent from the same studios. The deal also adds new minimum staffing requirements for TV writers' rooms based on the number of episodes. If ratified, this strike will go down in Hollywood history as its longest strike. It lasted 148 days.
On July 24th, residents of Parvin Estates, a development in the Northland, formed a tenant union. The union launched on July 24th. Last month, 12 union leaders met with Karen Fernandez, vice president of Yarko Companies, to discuss unlivable conditions and rent hikes. Yarko has agreed to meet most of the union's maintenance demands. However, the company refuses to negotiate on the Parvin tenants' central demand to reverse exorbitant rent hikes and put a cap on future rent increases at the complex. According to KC Tenants, Yarko is a multi-million dollar real estate company that operates across 9 states. Its business model is based on accessing money from state and local governments for the development and management of low-income housing, all while exploiting poor and working-class tenants. The company received $3.5 million in federal subsidies in 2022 for Parvin Estates alone. They then turned around and hiked the rent up to 35% for tenants at the complex in the past year. The Parvin Estates Tenant Union is demanding that all rent increases since January 1st be reversed and that the company commit to a 3% annual cap on any increases moving forward. Today, tenant union members and supporters held a press conference, marched around the area, and once again demanded negotiations.
The rent! The rent! The rent is too damn high! The rent! The rent! The rent is too damn high!
And the news from our side was read tonight by Judy Ansel, Morty Bortenson, and I'm Stephen Hill.
Up to California, from Mexico you come to the Sacramento Valley to toil in the sun. Your wife and seven children, they're working everyone, and what will you be giving to your brown-eyed children of the sun? Your face is lined and wrinkled, and your age is 41. Your back is bent from picking, like your dying time has come. Your children's eyes are smiling.
And that's Daniel Valdez with Brown Eyed Children of the Sun. On tonight's show, we're going to discuss a large group of workers that hardly anyone talks about, let alone the massive violations of their human rights and the lack of legal rights that they have. Those workers are farm workers, and there are a lot of them, picking and tending crops and animals that you eat, and even the fish that you catch. Most people don't even consider farm workers to be workers. Their work is not covered by the same laws as the rest of us. We'll find out why. And they don't have unions, at least none in Missouri. And many of them are neither white nor Americans, so we ignore them. But tonight, we're not going to do that. And with us to help shine a light on Missouri's exploited and abused farm workers are Julie Larson, supervising attorney at Missouri Legal Aid's Human Rights Protection Team and Farm Worker Project, also from Aaron Bartling, project director for the Farm Worker Project. Welcome to both of you, Julie and Aaron. And
thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And the inspiration for the show comes from Trent Taylor, staff attorney for Farm Worker Justice, a national organization based in Washington, D.C., aimed at empowering farm workers to improve health, living, and working conditions, and addresses immigration policy and advocacy. Trent was years ago a Heartland Labor Forum volunteer, so welcome back, Trent.
Thank you, Judy. It's great to be back.
So we're going to explore a case that Julie has written up, and both she and Aaron were involved in, and then talk about the rights that Missouri farm workers lack, how legal aid helps them, and what policy and law changes we need so that farm workers' lives can improve. So first off, Aaron, tell us, what crops do farm workers work in Missouri?
That's a great question. Missouri is extremely geographically and agriculturally diverse, just as are the people who work in those industries. In Missouri, you'll find peaches, apples, tomatoes, watermelons, pumpkins, horseradish, potatoes, nurseries, tree farms, cotton, rice, hemp, corn, soy, and not to mention chickens, hogs, fisheries, and goats, and many more. And construction on farms as well, which you might find surprising.
Really? Okay. And Trent, do you have any idea how many of those farm workers are there and where they come from? Because I imagine most of them are immigrants. Also, The story Julie is about to tell is about H-2A workers, and can you explain to us what an H-2A worker is? You're muted.
Sure, Judy. Farm workers are, the statistics on farm workers are kept by region, geographical region, through the National Agricultural Statistics Survey. And those regions are kind of lumped together with several states and regions. So it's hard to state exactly who the farm workers are in Missouri, but national statistics suggest that about 40 to 50% are undocumented workers. And of that group, most are from Mexico. We estimate that that figure is actually higher because of the reluctance of workers to report themselves as undocumented. Then about approximately 10% of farm workers are H-2A workers. An H-2A worker is a temporary seasonal agricultural worker. And that's the H-2A corresponds to the visa number that's accorded by the Department of Homeland Security. So again, 10%, and of that, about 95% come from Mexico, but employers are beginning to recruit more from other countries, such as South Africa, other countries in Central America, and elsewhere in the world.
Okay, and of course, they come for a specific amount of time. They can only work for the employer who engages them, and then they have to leave when the time is up. Is that correct?
That's right. The maximum amount of time that they can come for is 10 months. And thank you for pointing out that their status in the United States, their ability to work, is tied to one employer and only that employer. If they lose their job or they're terminated for some reason or the other, they are required to return back immediately to their home country.
Okay. So with that background, Julie, can you tell us the story that you wrote up, actually, about a group of farm workers who came to Missouri from Mexico?
Of course. And to do that, we will travel back in time to about 1 a.m., one early July morning. A crew of farm workers arrived to a seedy motel in rural Missouri. And at the end of the workday, one supervisor group, exasperated with the farm workers' delay in boarding the bus back to the motel. This supervisor mocked the farm worker for his impairment. He struggled to understand instructions and worked slowly in the watermelon fields. So instead of waiting for him to finish his dinner, the supervisor drove off without him, knowing full well he faced a 10-mile trek back to the motel. Luckily enough, a local farmer saw him walking alongside the road, picked him up, and took him to a community organization dedicated to upholding the rights of farm workers. Now, conditions for the rest of the crew were similarly rough. Workers were crowded into bedbug-infested motel rooms, sharing beds with coworkers, sleeping on stained and musty carpet. They used wadded-up sheets as pillows and damp towels as blankets. Some even slept on the tile bathroom floor. Their bosses forced them to work in the fields on days when the heat index reached 105 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, fearing their workers would be too sluggish to stoop over and pick watermelon, the bosses denied them breakfast. They berated farm workers who took breaks to drink water, which, of course, led them to decrease their water consumption to the point of dizziness and fainting. Now, when workers fainted from the heat, their bosses denied them medical care, simply dragging them under the bus until they regained consciousness. Workers had to urinate and defecate in the fields and use the juice from split open watermelons to wash their hands. They were only paid for a fraction of the hour's work and then asked to kick back those same wages to the company. Rumors began to spread about an inspection, and the bosses quickly cleaned up their act. They moved the workers to the Super 8 motel across the street, housing them only one or two to a room, and ordered them to lie to federal investigators about their pay, working conditions, and housing. Now, after the inspectors left, they moved them into an abandoned jail. Those who dared to ask questions feared deportation, harm to loved ones abroad, and blacklisting from future H-2H contracts. Yet despite all that was taken from them, these brave farm workers retained that which no one could appropriate: pride in their work, sacrificial love for their families, and stubborn hope in the accessibility of justice.
Well, you know, I'm sure, Julie, that took place over 100 years ago, right?
Oh, yes.
So when was it?
This happened in 2018.
2018. Okay, so 5 years ago. And I imagine it is somewhat typical of conditions in Missouri. Is that correct?
It is. Sadly, these same workers have, a few of them have returned on other H-2A contracts and have experienced similar, if not worse, conditions.
Okay, so real quick, just Julie and Trent, fire off the laws that were broken in this. I'll start with you, Trent.
Okay. Well, there are several housing provisions that control. These are federal, there's state and municipal housing regulations that were probably in violation. Those housing standards are very minimal. Those weren't obviously not met here. They're wage and hour violations, so violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act and state minimum wage laws. There are trafficking claims that are present under the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And then there would be violations under that, what's called the Agricultural Worker Protection Act, for several other provisions, such as the failure and the denial to rest breaks, to provide rest breaks, failure to provide adequate drinking water, failure to provide hand washing stations, et cetera.
Okay, I'm gonna stop you there.
Yeah.
Just for interest of time. That was Trent Taylor from the Farm Worker Justice Organization, and we're talking to Julie Larson and Aaron Bartling from Missouri Legal Aid. And Aaron, let me go to you and ask you, so what did the Migrant Farm Worker Project do for these workers?
Thanks for asking. Yeah, our team helped some of these workers access some small pieces of justice with the support and co-counseling with attorneys Greg Schell and Doug Stevick from Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid. We represented 20 workers by filing a lawsuit in federal court and recovered $145,000 for those workers. Additionally, five of those workers were granted continued presence as victims of trafficking, and 10 of them have also applied for UNT non-immigrant status. In addition to that work, the U.S. Department of Labor leveled civil penalties against the corporation, and a federal judge ordered them to pay restitution and undergo a 3-year probation for their actions.
Okay, and then, Julie, what happened to the workers after that? You said some of them actually returned, but what else did they get, or what kind of justice was there?
Well, it was really holistic justice, like, is what we like to say, because what was profoundly moving for Aaron and me was that they really emerged from the litigation with a sense of empowerment and a fire in their belly to just uphold the labor rights of similarly situated workers. And they also, of course, came out with money in their pockets that they used in ways that were really transforming and inspiring. Some invested them into home repairs, life-saving surgeries. We had some business startups, children's education funds, debt reduction, and even a few cows were purchased as a result of this. So it ran the gamut, but it was just neat.
Okay. Well, just real briefly, Aaron, back to you. I know you were outraged by this, but you must be outraged every day. Is that like... the common experience of you guys at Missouri, at the Farm Worker Justice Movement?
Unfortunately, yes, it is. You know, I thought this was kind of an exceptional case and unique, but over the years, we just see and hear the same stories happening over and over again. And some of these workers were brave enough and finally able to actually find another contract, and to come back and have that same experience happen again is just really disheartening. You know, the workers felt really demeaned, and the ones that have experienced this type of actions multiple times have said, I feel like I'm dispensable. I feel like a slave. I feel like nobody cares about me, and that I could die in a field and nobody would know. So they sacrifice so much and want to do things the right way. And so for them to be lied to, forced to lie, or asked to lie, and then end up empty-handed and in debt is really discouraging.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Trent, here's the last question. Why do farm workers have so few rights? Is it just because they're undocumented, or are there other things going on here? And what kind of policies do we need to fix this? Because we're all eating the food that they're producing. And I imagine most people would like to consume food that's produced in a way where the people aren't exploited like these folks are. So what's the solution?
Well, although the status of farm workers, many of, as you referenced, are undocumented, does affect their ability to exert civil rights, there are several other problems with the system. They are covered by many of the wage and hour laws that protect all other workers, but they're explicitly excluded from overtime. They do not have the right to join or form a union in 45 states.
And certainly not Missouri.
Certainly not Missouri. And they also face several other legal hurdles that because of the, you know, tenuous or undocumented status. As you mentioned, H-2A workers, they're tied to a single employer. So unlike you or me, who can, you know, walk down the road or hop on Indeed and find another job in the United States if their employer treats them poorly, they don't have that right. And for people who are undocumented, you know, that right is also constricted. So it is a huge chilling effect from the lack of status. The other things that impact their ability to exert their rights is that they are a indigent population. They don't have the resources to lobby for their rights or to place pressure for change in legislation. And the growers, those farmers, have an enormous power and resources to control the legislation that goes through Congress and through state legislatures. So there's that just incredible imbalance. The last thing that I would call notice to is that because of their roots of origin, they may not have language access to resources, and because or have unfamiliarity with the law or legal recourse, and because of their rural location, often they are isolated from the rest of the world. They're dependent upon their employer for transportation, for resources such as basic as healthcare or groceries. So all these things impact farm workers' ability to.
Okay, and real quickly, 30 seconds. What can we do about this?
Well, there is some legislation that will change, that attempts to change this. But as we all know, Congress is intransigent on these issues. Anything that involves immigration status is dead upon arrival because of the structure of the Senate, the representation in that regard. But the best thing that we can do is that we can support initiatives and legislation in our local states to change these laws. There is a trend towards granting farm workers overtime rights and collective bargaining rights. We've seen that number multiply over the past 5 years. It's slow, but it's important. So as I tell anyone, call your senator, call your representative, and demand what's right.
Okay, well, thanks so much. We've been talking to Trent Taylor, Aaron Bartling, and Julie Larson, and thanks much for staying tuned after a short public service announcement for our interview with Jobs with Justice's Erica Smiley by volunteer Jung Jin Lee. It starts with Pete Seeger singing Talkin' Union.
KKFI celebrates National Hispanic Heritage Month. While we acknowledge the limitations in our programming in language and time, we at KKFI emphatically recognize and honor the diverse histories, cultures, contributions, and resilience of all people whose heritage is linked to Latin America and the Caribbean, including the indigenous peoples of the region. KKFI encourages you to join us in celebrating the vast, generous, and positive impact those communities have made in these United States. We wish you a happy National Hispanic Heritage Month.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take a kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Because if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried.
You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I am your host, Zhongjin Lee, and on tonight's show, we will be talking to Erica Smiley, the Executive Director of Jobs with Justice, a longtime organizer and movement leader. Eric and her co-author, Sarita Gupter, just published a book called The Future We Need, Organizing for a Better Democracy in the 21st Century. Welcome. We are so excited you are here.
Hey, it's good to be here. It's Erica Smiley, but everyone's calling me Smiley.
Okay, great. Smiley, I hear you are coming to Kansas City on November the 16th for an event sponsored by Missouri Jobs with Justice to raise funds for the ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage to $15 and require employers to pay for sick leave. It will be at 6 p.m. at the Homesteader, and you will be doing a book signing. The Heartland Labor Forum will remind our listeners of this event as we get closer to the date. Would you give us some ideas about, you know, your own experience and what brought you to write this book?
Of course, yeah, Zhongjin, it's great to be on the show and to be in relationship with the folks in Missouri who are really fighting the good fight on these issues. I'm originally from North Carolina. I did not grow up with a labor family or in like a movement kind of environment, but I did grow up with a keen awareness of inequality and of being left behind by many of the rules that benefited working people in other parts of the country. At the time, as a youngster, it was more through the lens of race and understanding kind of what it meant for my people, my family, my community to have been exploited and kind of excluded from labor protections and the idea that we couldn't organize. But I grew to learn through various campaigns that there was more to it. In fact, I remember being in my teens and seeing several women, Black women who had worked at Kmart, take courageous action to walk out a strike against their employer in hopes of winning dignity and respect and fair wages at the job. And at the time, I didn't realize that they were doing that in order to form a union and to negotiate with the company. I thought they were just doing it because they had been treated unfairly because of racial injustice, gender injustice. But in fact, that was the lens through which they were fighting for a union with Act Two. And, you know, when we look at workers who are in motion today, we see that a lot of them are in motion, not just for what you would consider the bread and butter issues of better wages and healthcare. Those are incredibly important. That's certainly what they're fighting for. But the motivating factor that got them there was often around their treatment as people, as whole people. And so when you see some of the workers at Amazon, you know, they say, oh, this is our Black Lives Matter movement. Or one of the workers we interviewed in the book, Santione, talks about how her victory to win a women's bathroom on the shop floor at Ford in Texas was her women's liberation movement. Or even looking at the signs of Starbucks Workers United, Trader Joe's Workers United that prominently show the flag of the LGBTQ community as a part of their identity, their base, that there are these motivating factors that encourage people to take action and take risks where they wouldn't otherwise, that go beyond what we might consider just the economic issues. So it felt important for Sarita and me to put together a book as two women of color who were not necessarily considered, at least not at first, as a part of just traditional labor movement, to put together stories and theories from workers as women of color and as working people who are actually on the ground brainstorming and testing some of these ideas. And to show that not only can we write a book, but we aren't just writing something about our struggle in the labor movement as like we need to be included, but actually writing a book about what is to be done as leaders within that movement. And showcasing the workers within it to show that workers themselves were strategists. They aren't just leaders who tell their story, but we're actually designing some of the successful campaign strategies that we've seen in the last few decades and to kind of share their thought process on those. And then the last intervention we wanted to make, Jeongjin, is that, you know, we wanted to show that this thing that we call organizing, collective bargaining, you know, unions do, is not simply just a model for signing a contract that was, you know, designed in 1935, but mm-hmm. is actually something that should be expanded and evolved to meet the needs of modern workers, and that it needs to be evolved in large part because it is, in fact, one of the fundamental pillars of a healthy democracy. That if you think of democracy as the ability to incorporate the overwhelming majority, if not everyone, into a process for making decisions about their lives, or everyone in any given universe, community, neighborhood, like has a way to engage and help make decisions about their lives, pass policy, and then enforce it and change it when conditions change, then collective bargaining is really how you set policy and legislate for the workplace. It's how you engage the majority and setting, you know, the terms and standards that are agreed to and grieving them and enforcing them and changing them as conditions change in a employment environment. And so it's something that we feel like as a practice should be expanded to meet the ways that employment and frankly, other aspects of economic relationships, how it's organized in this period of time. And as much as it is a labor book, it is even more so a democracy book.
I was really moved by some of the collections you have regarding the profiles of modern workers. Right? In the book, you too let these workers speak about their own experience and how they struggled against their boss, against their working environment. And that was really impressive.
It is. And it is messy and it is very difficult. And so to be able to show that, to validate the experience of so many people who might be scared to do it, but then to show how people did it anyway and how they were successful, we felt was a really important thing to do.
So could you give us some ideas about why you think as of now collective bargaining is still worth fighting for in the workplace and is not sufficient just for the workplace, right? As you mentioned, it should be expanded, and you actually have a new expanded collective bargaining definition in the book.
That's right. If you think of things as the aspiring idea of something and then kind of the current practice or the current law, that's what we sought to do with collective bargaining. So if we think of something related but different, like the freedom of speech, there's like the aspiration of freedom of speech, and then there's how the law treats it, or all people are created equal. Well, there's the aspiration of that, and then there's like how it shows up in the law. And we have to constantly try to build towards the aspiration, right? And when we think of labor law, there's a law that was passed in 1935 that was passed after movements of workers really fought to have a framework to negotiate peacefully. Now, at the same time, right, there's the aspiration to say from the 13th Amendment to abolish all forms of slavery and forced servitude. And there's a question of like, how are we aspiring towards that? And what does the current law say is the framework through which to do it? The law is going to be more limited. So it's not to say that we're throwing out the National Labor Relations Act or the Railway Labor Act completely. In fact, many people were put on a path to economic sustainability through those laws in the last century. But what we are saying is that that wasn't the end-all be-all. That was a step towards trying to reach a more aspirational framework of freedom to control your labor and a more aspirational framework of democracy, where everyday people get to decide and set standards for their conditions and their environment. And so the expanded definition of collective bargaining is less a replacement as it is more of a reminder of what the point of what we're trying to do is, that it is not just to win this type of contract in this type of workplace, but that we need to figure out ways in which everyday people can collectively negotiate their conditions and their economic relationships in all kinds of employment environments and economic environments, whether we're talking about tenants with their corporate landlords, debtors with banks, that there are economic relationships all around us. And it doesn't just have to be something that we live under or suffer from, but can actually, it's not a passive, invisible hand, right? But that actually it's something that can be negotiated and changed if we organize in strategic ways.
This is what you mean by like considering all of us are not just the workers as the only identity we have, but we are whole people.
That's right. They're whole people. And when we think about democracy, oftentimes in this country, we think about it through the lens, almost exclusively through the lens of politics, of elections and being able to vote. And that is, it is a fundamental characteristic of democracy, but it is not the only one. And in fact, what we show is that when you ignore the other element of that, which is economic democracy, to be able to make decisions and vote on the conditions of our economic lives, that the political democracy starts to flounder. Over and over again, both at the very micro neighborhood or community level, as well as at the level of nation states, when you erode working people's ability to negotiate and set standards and govern themselves in their economic lives, in their employment lives, and in other parts of their economic lives, not only will they turn against you, and we're seeing a big rise of right-wing populism throughout the world, but also there it erodes the, it tends to be coupled with active efforts to erode the laws allowing people to equally participate in political democracy. And so there's a relationship there that we feel has been ignored to our own peril. And again, which is why I say this is a democracy book, in addition to being a book about labor strategies and working people who are trying to negotiate their conditions, that this is actually this upsurge that workers are having in this moment, who are organizing the collective bargaining contracts that are currently in motion at with the auto workers and the victory of the Teamsters at UPS. Like, these are not simply workers' rights fights. These are what I would consider on the front lines of trying to preserve and hopefully expand a healthy multiracial democracy.
In the book, you also mentioned, you know, historically, the differences we have in terms of our different identities, also in terms of our different political orientations, are used by the employers as a way to divide and conquer. Right. But now, how can we really fight against the divide and conquer strategies?
Right. This is really key because the, you know, it's very easy to say we should, right? But then there's the how that is where people get tripped up. One mistake that we feel people have made, and when I say people, like, you know, movement leaders and folks who are trying to tackle this issue with good intentions, is to shy away from it. to just go to the lowest common denominator and try to maintain unity at that level. However, we argue that you should lean into the mess, the beautiful mess, and lead with it, not just because it's morally right, or this idea of centering exploited communities or historically underrepresented communities. Like, that's important, and there's a theory there, but that actually leaning into it is oftentimes the key to winning. And there's a reason that unions and the labor movement writ large has often been called schools of democracy, or a place where people are in democracy, because it's one of the only places where people who may or may not share values or may come from very different communities, they come together at work and they have to engage. And so to struggle around the issues of racism and white supremacy through a shared context of having a shared employer, maybe the boss is coming after both of you, but you know, so you have to figure some stuff out, is one of those places where we can really tackle some of these broader system inequities. And to be able to show most directly, like we often say that transformation happens mostly in the trenches, that it's not just like one conversation that changes someone's mind. They have to see it. They have to see someone who they think is not malintentioned do something crazy, right, to themselves or to their coworker. And that creates a transformational opportunity. And so the key here, and like I think the Smithfield example is a great one in the book, where Lydia Victoria talks about having to unite both the Black and African-American workers who were on the slaughter floor and the Latinx workers who were in the meat cleaning and the white workers who were mostly like mechanics and the Native American workers, like having to figure out smart ways to unite them around this need for a union. And it was messy. It took 12 to 14 years before they won, and they're still having to fight. You know, even she ends the story with, I still walk the floor every day, multiple football fields, to like kind of keep people engaged, because otherwise they'll forget and they'll remain, you know, separated. But there is a magic and a transformation to being in struggle together, that there's no secret formula, right? There is just the messiness of being in active struggle together that not only allows us to tackle issues of race and gender as a company might use to divide workers, but also allows us to build a level of unity and strength and to understand our power in a way that allows us to win.
Exactly. So I wonder if you want to offer towards the end some takeaway messages for our listeners about your book from your experience, and give us some ideas how ordinary people and labor leaders can or should be part of the movement in building a better democracy together.
Absolutely. One of the big takeaways, just thinking about the current moment we are in with the contract fights and the organizing efforts that are happening, and just the democracy situation, I should say, right? And that we're coming in on a political election in the coming year. And of course, it's a very dynamic time. We're going in some ways through an industrial revolution. And the way that capital is organized is different. We have these multinational brands that actually control and set terms of production in a way that I don't think Robert Wagner and others could have predicted in 1935. And yet you've got workers who seemingly have no institutional power, you know, have not necessarily been activated. People who are not movement folks, don't come from, just like me when I was in North Carolina, you know, don't come from activist families and are experiencing these things for the first time through whatever lens they're experiencing them. And they're taking action. They're taking to the streets saying, we aren't going to wait. We just realized there's nobody going to save us but us. We have to try whether we win or lose. And next thing, we need a strategy. We need a plan. We're all suffering from prediction regrets when, you know, Starbucks workers started winning NLRB elections at coffee shops around the country, and Amazon labor union won in Staten Island. And all of a sudden you see Apple workers negotiating in Maryland. So I think the big takeaway I have is that support and trust the leadership of everyday people. You can never, ever underestimate the ability of everyday people to transform themselves and transform the rest of us. Secondly, to embrace the mess, because it's all messy. And anyone who tries to tell you that how we got to where we are today wasn't messy is lying. They just had to put it neatly in a book or something, but it was messy too. All of those leaders, people like to make all kinds of comments about the worker leaders of today, the Chris Smalls and others, and everyone's trying to bring them down and they're in trouble and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, okay, I mean, like the, as if Jimmy Hoffa and Walter Ruther weren't, you know, going fisticuffs in the streets, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And so like, it's messy and that's by design. And that's okay, right? Like that's actually how some of the really creative, and that's how we make progress, right? And then I think the last thing I'll say is that we're offering a framework for how to adapt, not so much a formula for how to design a campaign. We're showing how people think about bargaining broadly and then try to create applications that make sense for them in their context and their sector and their community or state. And that's got something for everyone, right? And leaning into this is less about just workers' rights, but is also about dignity for people as humans, and is about building a healthy democracy. That I think a lot of workers today who are leading these fights, even though they may not come from that activist family or that labor movement, traditional labor movement background, actually see their work as being on the cutting edge of trying to preserve democracy. In a moment when many of us are like, democracy is in crisis. One of my mentors always reminded me, never underestimate how quickly things can change. I think we're in one of those moments of having that agitation happen very quickly. I know I am, in the last couple of years, how quickly things can change.
Thank you. We are talking to Eric Smiley, who just published the book, The Future We Need, Organizing for a Better Democracy in the 21st Century. Thank you, Smiley.
Thank you, Zongzhen.
We are looking forward to your trip coming to Kansas City.
Oh, I'm looking forward to being there.
And that music means that we're talking to Mark Grunberg with Washington Window on workers. And Mark has just written an article called Trump Toots His Own Horn. God, I'm shocked. Uses electric vehicles as wedge issue with auto workers. So, hi, Mark. Tell us.
Hi.
Yeah, tell us what Trump did. I know he went to Michigan. Where'd he go?
He went to a non-union auto parts plant about 20 miles outside Detroit, and spoke to a hand-picked crowd. When I say hand-picked, I mean some staff vetted them to make sure they cheer. And basically, he said he used green jobs and used electric vehicles as a wedge issue, saying that, you know, if we're going to build electric vehicles, and he doesn't believe in that, you guys are going to be out of jobs. If you guys are going to be out of jobs.
Okay, so wait a sec. Were these union members or unorganized people?
Probably a mix. There may have been some stray union members in there. Certainly some union retirees. But mostly non-organized people.
Because you said that some had signs that said "Unionists for Trump," and okay. So his message was that electric vehicles are going to put union workers or auto workers out of jobs. Is there any truth to that?
There is some. That's one snag in the talks between UAW and the Detroit Big Three. It doesn't take as many workers to build an electric vehicle as it does to build a regular internal combustion engine vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what do you do with the extra workers? Do you retrain them? Do you find other jobs for them, or what? And many of these auto workers have been auto workers since they graduated high school. And their families are auto workers, and their grandfathers are auto workers, and their great uncles are auto workers. It's sort of like the big people in coal country. Everybody was a miner, and so as a result, they're somewhat resistant and scared of change that could put them out, that could force them to retrain themselves and put them out of jobs.
But another problem is that Ford, GM, and Stellantis aren't necessarily bound to produce electric cars in unionized plants. In fact, there's a problem with the Biden infrastructure bill, which is actually directing investment or incentives to the South. And so this is one of the reasons why the UAW has not endorsed Joe Biden. What do they want from him?
They basically want that commitment, that the investment, the dollars that are available from that law should go to union shops and union shops in blue states, although they don't use the word blue states, just as Biden himself promised.
Okay. And then, of course, Liz Shuler, the head of the AFL-CIO, had a statement about Trump. What did she say?
She said that workers won't be fooled, that his last term was a batch of lies for workers, and that they won't be fooled again this time. I love Liz, but I kind of feeling she's a sort of trying to sugarcoat it, because there are a lot of white men, blue-collar white men, union and non-union, who are going to vote for Trump.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's going to be up to Biden to fix. So,
yeah.
Thanks so much. Mark, we'll talk to you next month.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. And now for a very small little bit of the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. You can find our calendar on our Facebook page, and you can also like our Facebook page, and we're posting news, especially auto worker news, on it. So check it out. But there is going to be a meeting, Why We Can't Wait for the Department of Justice Intervention in Kansas City, Missouri, and Kansas City, Kansas Police Departments, Saturday at 11 a.m. at Roanoke Park, sponsored by Moore Squared. And then later that day, there's a unity rally to give Wyandotte County back to the power of the people. Saturday, September 30th, again, 2 to 5 p.m., and that's at Rosedale Park. And you can call 913-605-5570 for more information. The UU Forum this Sunday is Solving Kansas City's Housing Crisis with Save Inc.'s Tony Casey and Heather Bradley Gary. That's at 9:30 a.m. at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, or go to their website to get a link to their YouTube broadcast. And finally, the Inside Organizer School, September 29th to October 1st, Rochester, New York. To register, call, go to organizeupstate@gmail.com. And that's it for the Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be about the Jones Act, which is maritime union protection, which has a lot of opposition in Puerto Rico. So the question is it protection for maritime unions or is it colonial oppression? And the second part of the show is going to be about Puerto Rico labor history. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, and welcome back, Stephen Hill. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's a replay of Maria Vasquez Boyd's ArtSpeak Radio.
Been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back to us too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to Heartland Labor Forum KKFI at gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class.